Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I am joined by one of our contributing editors, Layla Lateef. Hi, Layla.
Hi.
Hi. So this week we are talking to filmmaker Robert Rodriguez about his Hitchcock homage, Hypnotic. Try saying all those H's at once. Plus, we're reviewing that and Paul Schrader's latest Lonely Man drama, Master Gardener, and the Disney live-action do-over, The Little Mermaid. So quite a diverse selection of films. But before we get onto that, what else have you been watching, Layla?
Oh, I've been watching a huge amount of TV, as I always am. But I kind of just started American Born Chinese this morning, which is really, really good fun and sweet and stuff, even though it has some of the worst CGI I've seen for quite a long time. But like the key little performances are really nice. It's kind of a show of two halves. There's like a high school drama going on and then like a connection to a supernatural side. And the high school drama stuff is way more interesting to me. It's not that great a sign for a show where it's just like, I don't care about the war. What's going to happen with the soccer team trials?
Yeah. Would you recommend it?
I would. It's fun. It's really fun. I'm having to binge it for work reasons, but I think in like little installments, it'd be really lovely. And it's Michelle Yeoh plays a goddess, and she is a goddess. Perfect casting.
Can't argue that. I've been down to Abbey Road this week to do a top secret feature. Can't say what it is, but it was very exciting. I enjoyed trying to get across the zebra crossing that I actually needed to get across in order to cross the road. But I had to wait several minutes to allow for people doing Beatles reenactments across it. So that was good. But I do love a little trip to Abbey Road, because no matter whether you're into anything that's been recorded there or even into music, it's this historical place that is so sort of marinated in a history of hugely cultural moments in time and albums and musicians that you can't help to be sort of overawed when you walk in there and walk into Studio One and think about everything that's been recorded there, from Elgar's Nimrod Symphony to, you know, the Beatles to Oasis and numerous other people. So, that's what I've been doing. So we'll have to wait and see what that is. Secrety secret.
I have to say, I did live quite near there for a time. And if you are driving around, that zebra crossing is a real pain. You are often stuck there for a very long time. I kind of can't get enough of Beatles content. So I love the Peter Jackson documentary series last year. I thought it was so good, and it's always amazing to think of like what a short time the Beatles kind of whole oeuvre is, and like how many times they transform. And I wonder when we're going to get that amazing Beatles biopic. I kind of want to see the scene where they at one point they all decide that they're getting mustaches just before Abbey Road.
Yeah, and it's all Paisley shirts and Elton John as a session musician in the corner, still called Dwight, all of that stuff. I'd love it. Yes, somebody please do that biopic. I'm into it. Shall we move on, though, away from anything that's real life into something else? We'll get started with this.
I know you called the tip in on the bank heist.
Who the hell are you?
What makes total strangers pull off an elaborate bank heist? Are you familiar with the concept of hypnotics?
Hypnotics.
Hypnotics have the ability to influence the brain, sound, voice.
Need a light?
Locking eyes. Hypnotics use them to make you see a version of the world that doesn't exist.
Dex?
It's not him anymore.
Dex, stop!
So this is Hypnotic, the latest from filmmaker Robert Rodriguez, and it stars Ben Affleck as a troubled cop, aren't they always, investigating a bank robbery that isn't quite what it seems. Before we get into that, and whether it's an arrestable offence or not, let's hear what Robert Rodriguez had to say when he sat down with our very own Molly Edwards earlier this week.
Hypnotics make everything that you see and do feel perfectly normal.
So I wanted to start with talking about how this seems like quite a passion project for you. Like, you first had the idea in 2002, and now over 20 years later, the film is finally here. So how would you kind of describe the experience of bringing Hypnotic to the screen across the decades?
Wow, and it's unprecedented. I've never had an idea for that long go unproduced. But I was glad I stuck with it, because it was just very satisfying on so many ways. And in a weird way, it feels like this was the perfect time to make it. Like, I wouldn't have had all the answers I needed even 5 years ago, or the cast that I have. So everything's got its time. You're just tenacious and stick with it. I would have not known to tell people 20 years is fine. I would have said, okay, maybe that's a little too long. But now that it's happened, I go, okay, 20 years, easily, fine. That's still, it's not rotten yet. But it was just an idea that always grabbed me because I just thought, it reminds me so much about what we do. The more I made movies, the more it's like what we do as storytellers. It's, we create, our job is to create a hypnotic construct for an audience that pays money to come see a construct. They know it's actors, they know it's lines, they know it's fake, but they want you to do your job well enough, hypnotize them enough that they believe it's real enough to cry or laugh or tell their friends to go see it, come see it again and again. And sometimes they latch on to characters and worlds so much that they value them more than their own real friends. So it's pretty cool. So I thought, I want that to be in the movie, very meta-like, when you start seeing the layers unveiling, that you don't know what's real, what's not, and what's a construct, and that it's happening in the theater and it's happening within the movie to you as well.
And it's also, as much as there's all this like twisty hypnotic stuff going on, which is really cool, there's also, it's really a film about family and like a father's love for his daughter. So I was wondering, why did you want to put that at the heart of the film?
I didn't have a daughter yet when I wrote the movie originally. And then later, as I was making it, I was like, oh, it didn't have that, have the final twist in there, that I wanted to lean it back more towards family. It ended earlier. And so, you know, some of the big twists in the movie changed the whole perception of the movie. And I wanted that element in there because it's just a big part of my life. I'm from a family of 10 kids. I've got five of my own. My youngest is my daughter. And so she always had these elaborate braids. And a lot of that stuff is just like our relationship. She is magic. She has a lot of magical qualities. So I wanted just to have that aspect in there.
And speaking of family, I know your children were involved in production. So how did you find like collaborating with them creatively on the project? Like, how has that kind of evolved and changed? Because I know like you have worked with them before.
They've been working with me since they could crawl. I mean, literally, they were stunt kids in the Spy Kid movies and actors. And they were already generating stories that became big screen movies since they were really little, 7 and 8 for Sharkboy and Lavagirl. And then they grew into these positions where, I like my son, I gave my kids piano lessons just to connect their left and right side of their brain initially. I didn't realize that by starting them at the age of 4, that they would become smoking composers and blow me out of the water and take my job from me. There's so much better. My son's so much better than me as a composer that he now has that job full time. My other son's my writer and co-producer. My other one's my co-editor. My other one's my designs my sets with this game engine. They're just way into stuff that has always been part of the family business. And they're just my favorite collaborators because the harder we work, the more time we spend together as a family. Where most jobs would keep you from your family, the harder you worked at it. So by having them all part of it, we just having a blast all the time, being creative, coming up with new stories, coming up with ways to make the process even better. They're innovating a bunch of ways they're going to help me make movies in the future that I wouldn't have thought of. So it's essential to my process to have them part of it.
And you mentioned the cast. You have the protagonist is played by Ben Affleck. So I was wondering, like, how did he come aboard the project? Because without spoiling anything, it's a role that really requires kind of different versions of the same character in one performance almost as the story unfolds.
Yeah, I mean, I picked him because of what you see him in the first few scenes. You know, he's got this, he's a very driven detective. I knew he could do that. He's a star. That's what I loved about the Hitchcock movies. Hitchcock could make movies with non-stars, but when he did it at his best, it was with Cary Grant, James Stewart, you know. So I thought, I need a star like that to really ground the movie. And then the fact that he actually is a father and is always talking about his kids too. We talk about our kids all the time. That I knew that his genuine warmth as a father was the other side of that driven detective. And he's from the 90s indie filmmaking. So when our schedule got really short, I knew he'd be able to do it because he was used to shooting that way too, like I was.
And there's also, again, without getting into spoilers, there is a mid-credits tease that kind of suggests the story isn't over just yet. So do you have like plans to revisit the story again, or do you have like ideas on where you might take it next?
I do have plans. I didn't know if the mid-credits sequence was pushed too far down and then everybody was going to see it, but I'm glad you got to see it because I like that part of it. I wish I'd put it a little earlier. Yeah, it's pretty far down the credit line. Hopefully people see it.
I'm sure people will. But I was wondering, like, did it go through a lot of different versions? Like, if this was an idea that you had for so long, like, was there anything you ended up taking out or putting back in that really changed the project a lot?
I mean, yeah, you change things over time. A lot of the stuff that's still there, like the heist, him being a detective, him having a daughter that's lost, him the scissors scene, the some of the big twists, some of the later twists. I think I mentioned I didn't come up with till later, but the DNA of everything was pretty much in there. As we came up with other ways to tell the story, some things changed, but yeah, it's just a natural progression of changes that happen. You ended up with the final version being the definitive version for sure.
I wanted to ask as well about why did you decide on kind of putting these sci-fi concepts in with what seems like at first to be quite a straightforward police thriller, like with some hints that there's more going on, but it does get very big as the film goes on.
Yeah, I just my whole trick has always been to have just a really big idea, no matter what size your budget was. So if you have a small budget or a medium-sized budget, just have a huge idea, because that'll just open up the film. So you don't need a big budget. In fact, as our budget shrunk, it actually helped the movie to have just like a golf cart go around and stuff. It actually made the hypnotics that much more powerful that they could fool people like that. So I thought, come up with a really big idea and have even elements that feel even almost like sci-fi. It just makes the idea bigger. And because if you thought the movie was just going to be about hypnosis, you wouldn't expect that. So that's why the word hypnotic means it could be anything. It could mean people with very otherworldly powers.
Okay, so that is Molly and Robert talking about Hypnotic. Layla, just set it up again for anyone who's not really got the gist of what this is about. What is a hypnotic?
So yeah, we've got this police officer that you mentioned who's very traumatized because his child disappeared and by someone who has no memory of kidnapping her and they never found the body. Then he discovers that there is this world of hypnotics, which is just kind of people with like almost like a psychic power. They can just walk up to people and say something and their entire world sort of transforms and you can make them do anything from kind of rob a bank to kind of skewer themselves through the head with a spike or basically anything you want. And there is this sort of the most powerful hypnotic is kind of on the loose and seems to have some connection to the disappearance of his daughter. And he kind of enters this world of like increasingly you can't believe what you see, you can't believe who anyone is, what their intentions are, because and your mind can just be manipulated.
We have a interview with Robert in the next issue, which is out on sale today. So do go and buy that and read that. When I sat down with him, and he sort of talked about this being very much his version of a Hitchcock, that he was watching a lot of Hitchcock films and wanted to sort of create this idea of if you took a word, hypnotic, what would that story be? Does he succeed?
I don't see that much, I have to say. I mean, there is some sort of MacGuffin-y stuff, and like I suppose Hitchcock does a lot of that classic kind of man on the run from the authorities who falsely think he's done a crime. There's a bit of that in there. I was getting more kind of a bit of like, the kind of the big dumb 90s action thriller sort of things, which is, things that I like, but kind of more of a face-off sort of
Yes.
and a bit of Inception thrown in there, I'd say as well. I mean, I actually have to say I had a really fun time watching it. And I
Yeah.
think a lot of that came down to a film that we're gonna go talk about later, which was so had such pacing issues. And this is like full speed ahead at all points. I mean, I was kind of checking my watch, but in like a good way, being like, I can't believe that like so much has happened. And my God, only like 27 minutes have passed. There
Yeah.
are four plot twists, this many action pieces. And I kind of found that all really fun. But I'm kind of surprised it's not a streaming movie because to me, this seemed like very much something you'd watch on the sofa.
It's not done very well in box office in America. It has been Ben Affleck's worst performance at the box office of his career, apparently. So it hasn't taken in America. It's obviously on release here this week. I think it's sort of one of those very sort of disposable, in as much as you probably won't think about it much after you've left the cinema. But in the moment, it's just a romp and it does crack along. It pulls the rug numerous times. This is like, sort of when you see those masterclasses on how to make a movie or how to write a thriller novel, and you have to do like a beat sheet, which is the 15 beats in a story where it's like, who is our protagonists. What do they want? How are they going to get it? Who's going to help them? What's going to befall them? Here come the bad guys. Here comes redemption. Here comes a twist. And here comes the end. I'm paraphrasing, but it feels like this is absolutely that. And not in a rote way, and not in a, I don't mean that in a sort of that it's boring to watch, but just that it's efficiently put together. It's incredibly sort of efficient in doing exactly what it says on the tin, which is thriller. And also, when you think about it, in comparison to Ben Affleck's last thriller that he attempted, Deep Water, this is a marked improvement, So yeah, I quite enjoyed it. I liked, you know, the Inception-y sort of vibe that was going on. You know, there's bits where buildings fold up and worlds sort of morph. I like that. It was apparently written before Inception. Please don't tell Robert Rodriguez that you think it's like that, because he predates it. But yeah, it's not as dense and as rich and as nuanced as Inception. But in terms of that sort of romp and the idea of multiple realities, it's pretty good.
I mean, that's the thing why I think maybe I felt it was a good sofa movie, because it actually does keep you engaged. You're not going to really be looking at the phone so much. You're kind of really like struggling to keep up with it. It's not switch your mind off dumb fun. Like, you do actually have to kind of work to follow it. And it's very easy to kind of stay engaged with it because so many exciting things keep happening. I don't think it's going to be considered like the greatest of Robert Rodriguez's oeuvre. But yeah, I'm kind of surprised it did badly, because I just thought, you know, good time at the movies here.
Yeah, I enjoyed seeing Ben Affleck sort of getting into this, back into his sort of 90s mode. You know, this is a sort of film that he could have made, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and it would be decent then as well. It sort of reminded me of Changing Lanes, the 2002 film that Ben Affleck was in. It's that sort of vibe, that sort of feel. And I'm not mad about that.
No, me neither. I mean, this and kind of Michael Bay's Ambulance probably sit around the similar place to me, where it's just like a full pedal to the metal, like, let's just go. And, you know, it's escapism, but in like quite a fun way. And it's not trying to be too much smarter than it is, but it's also not completely, you know, dumb. Like, it's not like a so bad it's good type of joy. It's like, oh no, there's actually like some stuff here, and most of this kind of does make sense by the end, even though the concept has been so wild. I think I probably have come up with a couple of plot holes, but I'll leave that for if I ever get to interview Robert Rodriguez myself.
Yeah, and pick his brains. I mean, I think this would be an excellent one for a plane.
Excellent one for a plane. I'm trying to think if there's any plane crashes in it, because that's what I never want to see on a plane. And I'm always surprised when you do get on a plane and feel that, like, they, you know, they edit out sex scenes a lot of the time. Edit out the plane crashes. I don't want to see that when I'm 30,000 feet in the air.
Well, BA does give you a disclaimer if you've got, I watched the George Clooney, Julia Roberts film, Ticket to Paradise, and I had a disclaimer to tell me there was discussion of unpleasant air travel in it before I started watching it. So I think you're not flying with the right people, Layla.
No, clearly not. I need to be taking flights with people that care about my emotional health more.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so on this level, we've digressed onto emotional health on planes, but Hypnotic is a recommendation for this week.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I kind of have a feeling with Hypnotic where it's going to be one of those weird things that happens with Netflix, where in like 6 years, this is just going to be number one on Netflix for like no reason, as everybody, it's just a bit of word of mouth about this like really fun thriller that's out there. So even if it's disappointed at the American box office, hopefully do better here and then kind of get a second wind a bit later on.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so if you fancy a bit of Hypnotic, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, let's move on to our next film for this week, from one man with a dark past to another. It's this.
I have a favor to ask.
What is it?
My grandniece. I would like you to take her on as an apprentice. She dropped out of school and then she ended up in a bad crowd.
You'll learn how to garden.
Are you satisfied with the life that you have?
Why would you ask that? You know, you talk a lot of shit, but there's one thing you don't talk about.
What's that?
Yourself.
Well, there's not much to know.
Okay, so this is Master Gardener, which you and I saw at Venice Film Festival last year, did we not?
We did. And then weirdly, also just afterwards, I saw Paul Schrader walking around and he looked so unwell. And then I kind of got news that he'd gotten unwell and then has made a wonderful recovery. So I'm kind of very pleased that, like, my second time coming to Master Gardener, it's with Paul Schrader in, like, much better health and hopefully lots more projects from him. But yeah, what a glamorous place to take in a lovely garden.
Yes, it is. So tell us, who is the Master Gardener and what is he up to?
So the Master Gardener is a man called Narvel Roth, who is played by
Joel. Which is a very strange name, Narvel. Have you ever come across a Narvel before?
I have not. Yeah, what is going on with that? Does that exist ever?
I don't know.
I mean, I've never met a Chandler, but I'm aware there is Raymond Chandler and Chandler from Friends. So I've never even heard of this in anything.
No, Narvel. I haven't. If you're called Narvel, let us know, because I have never come across this before, ever. But anyway, I'm digressing. Carry on. What is Narvel up to?
So the curiously named Narvel Roth is this gardener who runs this place, Gracewood Gardens, which is this kind of gorgeous estate owned by a very wealthy and kind of 1950s glamorous Sigourney Weaver. He plays Norma Haverhill. He kind of runs this garden as kind of a place that people kind of come and display. And he's also got a kind of very weird Oedipal relationship with Norma herself. One day she says that she's got this kind of troubled great niece who is in need of some help and a job. And would he kind of take her on as an apprentice? And of course, because it's Paul Schrader, that's not what this film is about. Narvel has a terrible, terrible path that's going to be unveiled. And Norma herself is something of a monster. So this kind of young woman, Maya, comes in thinking that she's got a kind of lovely job opportunity on her hands and finds herself in a very, very dark and twisted world.
Yes. So, I mean, obviously, Schrader has recently sort of done well with The Card Counter. This is the next one after that. So it's very much in the same vein as that, you know, tortured monastic man living this sort of ritualistic life to escape something dark in his past. How does this compare to The Card Counter for you?
I kind of think of them as a three, with like First Reformed, Card Counter and this one. And First Reformed is number one for me. And then Card Counter and Master Gardener are about on par with one another. I really like how Paul Schrader just doesn't really care if anyone likes him. He doesn't really care if kind of you find his movies sympathetic. He's happy to be like really edgy and just kind of do his own thing that he finds interesting. I remember just before this came out, because Card Counter, I think, was on Barack Obama's favorite films of the year, and he was gleefully saying like, Master Gardener's not gonna make the cut, Obama's not gonna like this one. But I reckon he might, actually, because I thought it was just really interesting, and Joel Edgerton's absolutely amazing in it. People are complicated, people can do terrible things, redemption is available to most, and I think that that's a kind of message that you can get on board with, even when it's taken to a real extreme, because when we talk about a dark path in terms of Mr. Narvel Roth, we're talking really dark.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. And we don't want to give too many spoilers away, but his past and his possible future with this niece is very complicated based on his previous beliefs and what he might be going forward with and how he has marked his body with those beliefs. In terms of a sort of a study of race and redemption, it's quite interesting and to set this in the South and within this sort of antebellum world of plantations and Spanish moss and the mistress up at the house in Sigourney Weaver, it actually has quite a lot to say. But the thing I liked about it is it doesn't kind of bother with that. It's in there, the subtext, you can pick at that if you want, but really it's a sort of strange romance between the two of them, with this third wheel in Sigourney Weaver, who's sort of this maven trying to control that. And there's scenes in it that are just joyful and lovely. There's a scene when they're driving along in the dark and the verdures are just blooming and beautiful. It sort of bit reminds me of that bit in The Card Counter when they go to the sort of lit up illuminated garden and it's beautiful and there's this moment of gorgeousness. You do get that in this, and there is a lot of hope in this film, even though it's quite bleak. I felt like it's Paul Schrader a little bit softening, not in a softening and losing his edge, but in a softening and perhaps being a little bit more optimistic than he usually is. Did you feel that?
Yeah, definitely. And it's kind of nice that in this kind of stage of his career that he is able to kind of end on a little bit of optimism rather than that sort of like really bleak nihilism that so often comes at the end of these. But yeah, it's also just gorgeous. I just love watching all of those flowers bloom. I think the way he lights stuff and stuff that shouldn't be very cinematic, somebody sitting at a desk writing a journal, but somehow it's just done in a way that's, you know, so compelling. You know, I love Joel Edgerton. I interviewed him for you guys a while back when he was doing Underground Railroad, which is another difficult part to take on. He's playing like a slave catcher and stuff like that. But he's so articulate on those kind of issues and the difficulties around them and how he kind of views these characters and stuff. And I really thought he brought this to this as well, because I think a lot of actors wouldn't be brave enough to take on Narbel Roth.
Yes. And let's talk about
Sigourney Weaver. Saying it. Narbel Roth.
Narbel Roth. Let's talk about Sigourney Weaver then as this maven in her pearls and her twin set, stalking around her gardens, loving having this man under her thumb in every way. He is sowing her garden in every way when she commands it. There's a wonderful scene at a dinner table when a lunch goes completely askew. Do you enjoy seeing Sigourney flex her acting muscles like that? I really did.
Yeah, I feel like we haven't gotten enough Sigourney villains in the past because she's so kind of vicious in so many of these scenes. And it's that sort of like so many scenes where she's being very proper and very polite, but also terrifying at the same time. It is really interesting to see where this kind of pair has come, because I was watching it again. I was like, oh, I remember when Joel Edgerton and Sigourney Weaver were last together. And it was in that Ridley Scott Ancient Egypt film where they got a load of flack for playing.
Oh, my God. I had completely forgotten about the existence of that. Yeah,
I think they'd probably prefer that.
Yes.
And this is a much better teaming up if you're going to watch one thing over the other. Strangely, the one which has big twist is the less problematic.
Yes, absolutely agree. Do not watch that. What was it even called?
Gods and something.
Gods in Egypt. I mean, it was just awful on many, many levels. God bless you, Ridley, but seriously, this is far superior. You want to see this at the cinema. You want to really take this in and luxuriate in it, in this world that's been created in the South. You want to have a mint julep on hand, I'd say.
I'm going to go get some fancy wallpaper. There's some incredible wallpaper around.
Incredible wallpaper. I do love her interior design. And you might even fancy taking up a bit of gardening afterwards, because gardening is prominent in this, which sounds very dull. But the way Joel Edgerton reads off the sort of genus of flowers and how you graft one onto another is intoxicating.
Yeah, it is. And I do feel, because we are being great film critics and not giving away the twist, I hope nobody thinks that they're actually just going to watch a film about gardening. It's not about that. It is like a dark, twisted, violent thriller at many points as well. So, yeah, not something to take your nan to, because, you know, she loves kind of pruning her roses.
No, but you will get some arse in it. So, you know, Gran might like that.
That's what she's into, I suppose.
There is some male nudity. So there you are. OK, so I think we're saying we recommend The Master Gardener for a Saturday night out.
Yes, highly recommend this one. And please, Paul Schrader, take good care of yourself, because I want to see much more stuff from you.
Yes, we do. Let's see your next lonely man. Who knows what he'll be doing? I love the card counter and this one, the sort of precision of somebody's life, the routine and the things that they do, the rituals that they go through to sort of care for themselves. I find that fascinating. So I'd like to see another one. So yes, please, Paul, that will be next on the list. Okay, shall we move on to something completely different? Not a lonely man, but a fishy girl. It's time to go down where it's better because it's wetter. Still a lyric I'm not happy with. It's this.
You broke the rules. You went to the above world.
A man was drowning. I had to save him.
This obsession with humans has to stop.
I just want to know more about them.
Ariel! Don't!
Poor child.
I can help you. You can't live in that world unless you become a human yourself.
Is that even possible?
It's what I live for.
Ha 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 ha! Okay, so this is The Little Mermaid, Disney's live-action redo of the classic animated version. Layla, for those of us who have been living under a rock under the sea, what is this about?
So this is kind of an adaptation of the, I suppose the original was like 1833 Hans Christian Andersen Danish tale of a little mermaid, which had a very, very, very sad ending. Do not read it as a, to your children because they will end up getting very upset. Most of us know it from the kind of Disney version, which kind of has a much happier ending and is about this lovely little redheaded mermaid who falls in love with Prince Eric and decides that she wants to go onto the land. And then a terrible sea witch called Ursula says that she will make a deal with her where you can go to land, you have 3 days to get true love's kiss, and then you can kind of be a person forever. Otherwise, you'll essentially become a mermaid again and become my slave. And the original stands up because I rewatched it with my kids about a week and a half ago, and it is absolutely so much fun. So you appreciate how many good songs there are in it. I mean, often I feel like with some of the more recent Disneys, it's just like, oh, here's the one bop. But this one just had so many great ones. And I was listening to the lyrics so much and thinking how great they are. And they're so witty. So was not generally a fan of a live action remake, but came into this one a bit more optimistic. And Halle Bailey is playing Ariel herself. And there's a lot of controversy around that because Little Mermaid has been white in the past and they have her here as a, you know, as a black mermaid, but still with the long flowing red hair. Her aside and David Diggs as Sebastian aside, I just found this such a slog. And the thing that I was most shocked by is I thought the race stuff was absolutely bizarre. I have no idea why you couldn't just have it in Denmark, right? You could just have it in Denmark. She is a sea creature. She can be of any race. I see no issue with kind of having any race in that. And I think with kids' films, it's nice that different children of different races see themselves represented on screen. They said it in the Caribbean, which is a very specific time in history, early 19th century.
Yeah, there may have been Caribbean. Some issues there. Problematic that should might have been happening concurrently above the ocean.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a very different thing with me kind of coming to it expecting just like, oh, colorblind, whatever, you know, I think this is all perfectly fine. She's a fantastic singer. I think she's going to be a big star. But I was just like, do you guys not get how weird it is that we have white prince of a Caribbean island where there all the nobility is speaking with English accents? And then everybody else is speaking in a Caribbean accent in the early 19th century. And Prince Eric keeps going on about how he wants to increase trade with like Brazil and Portugal. And I was like, what trade are we talking about there, buddy?
Because what have you got to sell, Prince Eric? What is it in your boats?
I need you to specify because of exactly this bizarre choice where they were like, we're going to not just have a black little mermaid, we're going to have it in the Caribbean as well, but then also keep the time period.
They try to offset that by giving Prince Eric an adopted black mother who is the queen, but that sort of seems very much sort of like a piecemeal offering. It just doesn't offset this sort of discomfort. And also there has been criticism about the fact that the Caribbean accents that are used in this are just sort of weird, sort of general, you know, central casting Caribbean accents and not specific. And that if you are from Bermuda, you absolutely do not sound like the same as somebody from a different island or from a different, you know, country. They're all very different. And so this sort of, we've done the Caribbean, but we've just made it a sort of one tone Caribbean. And this is what it sounds like. That's become problematic to people as well. I mean, yeah. I have to say, my ear is not attuned to different dialects. So for me, I couldn't tell that about it, but I understand that that is an issue for people. I love her. I think she is just pure light and she's everything you want a Disney princess to be. And whenever she's on screen, just I was mesmerized by her. I felt for her. I wanted to know where she would go next, what she was feeling. And I felt I could see that written on her face because obviously when she goes on land, she loses her voice. And so but for Halle, she has to really emote and she's delightful at it. Love Melissa McCarthy. And I think she did a perfectly good job here, but it doesn't feel as sinister as when you watch Ursula in the animation. And I really can't get to the locus of what that is that's not firing. Sebastian is crazy looking in real life, when you take that crab and you put those mad eyes on it, it's like, why would you want that near you? It's a monster.
Yeah, I found Flounder just had cold, dead eyes in a way that I was very unsettling.
And Flounder, when he starts singing with his mouth half in and half out of the water, is terrifying. Scuttle, most valuable player. Awkwafina as Scuttle, bringing all of the comedy. Then you've got Javier Bardem as the king of Atlantis, sort of underneath the water with his prong and his fish and all of that stuff. Perfectly good. Love it. Yeah. Apart from when he's out of the water at some point and he's head and shoulders and he's got a bedraggled wig and suddenly it feels very unmagical.
That was a moment, and then, wasn't it?
Yeah. And let's talk about Prince Eric. Ah, this kid, clearly a sweet guy. Hopeless, isn't he? He's been given a new song. It's not a very good one. He's really blank. They try to give Prince Eric some agency as well as Ariel. Don't believe it for a minute for the reasons you've already mentioned. I just found him. Why would you fall in love with this doofus? I don't know. I mean, we don't see very many of them, but they're surely really hot mermen that you could be getting the quivers for instead of this fool that falls off boats.
I know. And they try and kind of make their love story more interesting because then they have kind of parallel things of like his mother is trying to ban him from the sea whilst her father is trying to ban her from the land. And there's just like these other plot details that come in that, like, you know, Titan and Ursula are brother and sister, don't you know? Or like, you know, those kind of things. And having just watched the original, I'm just like, there is no need for this.
Yeah, simple is
better.
None
of those things go anywhere or add anything to this. And the pacing. I mean, not only the second a palm tree appeared, I was distracted. But like, there was one point again, looking at my watch in the bad way, where I was just like, "Oh, we've seriously been here for an hour, and Ariel and Ursula have not met yet."
Yes, yes. Only her conger eels have been passed, who I did like. Her sinister conger eels were excellent.
Yeah. Eels are scary.
And then we also have this idea as well that the sort of trying to make a happy ending out of this, which can't possibly be really, because how can a fishy person and a land person live in a sort of, they try to find this third place that they could live, because obviously one of them has to leave everything behind in order to live with the other. And so they try to soften that. And actually the Hans Christian Andersen one is really bleak and hard and tough. And it's about the fact that when this happens, it's not necessarily happy endings all the way, because these things are tough and assimilation is hard and giving up everything you know for someone you love is really hard. Yeah, it felt like they'd sort of tried to smooth the edges of that too much by the end, that I was just a bit, I sort of feel like the investment is really gone now, because it just feels like such a perfect ending that it doesn't feel remotely anything I can relate to.
It just felt like there were some weird ideas that I thought were going to zig and then they zag, because they have a huge amount of this runtime is given up to like geopolitical issues between the sea people and the human people over the issue of whether these shipwrecks are happening on purpose because they damage the reef. And I was like, well, I mean, I could see that it makes sense that we have some nice, we should take care of the sea stuff in here, because yes, we all should take care of the sea. But like, oh, these humans are littering our reef with their dead bodies seems to be like a really weird choice. And then I thought it was going to be that like Ariel was going to come to land and kind of exact change and like make people take care of the sea better. And like that was going to be her empowering thing. But no, not really. They're just doing off to do some non-specific and, you know, slightly sinister sounding trade with Brazil and Portugal from the Caribbean. Yeah.
And let's make sure she's in a pink dress by the end, eh?
Yeah, no, I was just so confused throughout. And I would say I did see this with my kids. And it's also pretty intense for kids. There's a scene from the original where there are shark attacks, which, yes, you know, in the cartoon, okay, you've kind of like, that's one thing. When you're watching it with like this live action remake, you're actually watching something that could be out of, you know, Jaws or Deep Blue Sea. Like, she's being properly chased by a shark and those eels are really scary. And Ursula, for some reason, this entire lair is surrounded by human skulls. I mean, it's like we really like went strangely dark as well for a kid's film.
Yes. I mean, if you're a massive Disney fan, maybe you'll like this because it's more of what you love, but in a different medium. And because it's not drastically changing anything, it's just tweaking, it will scratch that itch. You get to see Under the Sea. You get to see stingrays and all sorts of things floating about. And, you know, those Under the Sea bits are well done. You know, the hair,
really
the floating
it.
Hair and the way that it's been so carefully done. But I wish the same care had been sort of given to the story and the script to just, if you're going to empower her, properly empower her. And if you're going to make him more interesting, make him more interesting. Yeah, but they didn't.
When she sings Part of Your World, I mean, I love the Under the Sea kind of, that's probably my favourite song from it. But when Hallie sings A Part of Your World, I was just like, my God, this is perfect. She's got such a beautiful voice and she emotes so well through it. Like, it's almost worth watching just for her. But it's also more than 2 hours long for no reason. And the original was 83 and was great.
Okay, so if you fancy, you know, 2 hours of The Little Mermaid, it is out in cinemas on Friday. So a reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you are all set. And also we should say that today is new issue day. It is the world exclusive of Oppenheimer. It's coming. Christopher Nolan's massive biopic of Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb.
I am going to be a fan more than a contributor of this issue. I'm so excited for Oppenheimer. Thrilled for Matt Matum that he gets to have all of his like Christopher Nolan dreams come true. Been cooking something up for the issue that comes after instead. So that's been my focus.
There is something special coming from Layla in next issue, so next month. But for this issue, it is Oppenheimer and it's also Secret Invasion. It's Witcher 3. It's The Flash. It's Robert Rodriguez. It's Barbie. It's Sydney Sweeney. It's Extraction 2. It's Isabelle Huppert and the greatest comic book movies not featuring superheroes. I mean, there's just a whole load of stuff in there. It's a proper explosion into your eyes. So do pop out and get hold of the new issue. That's all we have time for this week. We will be back next week. I won't be because I'm going to Graceland to go on the
Dreams
Odyssey.
Come true.
Yeah, I'm fully having a Make-A-Wish Foundation for myself. And I'm going to Graceland on a VIP ticket to do everything. So it will be Jordan Farley helming next week. So do come back then. But for now, we have time for a reader's question. Are you ready? What is your favourite one-star movie and your least favourite five-star movie? That is an excellent question. Layla.
It's a tricky one for me because I do love a So Bad It's Good movie. So like in terms of favourite one-stars, there's so many to go from. But I have a particular delight from Lindsay Lohan's Elizabeth Taylor biopic, Liz and Dick. It's so bad. It's fascinating. It is just so terrible. She's awful in it. The kind of budget is so kind of janky. And then the fact that like the subject is Elizabeth Taylor, who was so kind of so magnetic and glamorous to kind of, it becomes so unintentionally hilarious and enjoyable to kind of watch her legacy being so sullied. And The Room, of course, a classic.
Yes.
But in terms of like five-star movies that I think are really bad, after I watched The Fabelmans, I felt that I should fill this gap in my knowledge and watch The Greatest Show on Earth, because that's the film that young Steven Spielberg watches that inspires him to get into the movies. I thought it was one of the most boring things I've ever seen. I thought it was so ugly and uninteresting. And I was just, I could not believe that this was like the origin story for Steven Spielberg. I mean, even Jimmy Stewart doesn't manage to save that movie. That is real Emperor Has No Clothes. Cannot understand why that's a classic.
Yes. Okay, cool. My one star, I don't even know if this was ever a one star, but people hate it, but I love it. Waterworld. It's just awful. Kevin Costner with gills makes no sense. There's very dodgy sort of problematic sexual politics happening in it. Yeah, it's awful. It was dreadful. I love it and will watch it anytime I come across it on telly. And five-star movie that I despise, The Master. Just never want to see it again. Absolutely, like, makes me angry to think about it. It's so not my film. So I'm not saying I think it's not a five-star, because clearly everyone else does, but it is not masterful in any way to me. It's just indulgent and irritating. So that's my 1-star, 5-star.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's one of those films that if you're not vibing with it, I can see how that would be a torture. That is a long time to not be absorbed by kind of quite slow moving, subtle stuff.
Yes, it is not for me. And so it's hours I will not get back. Jamie, as we know, Jamie Graham is a huge fan of it. And I think he'd really like me to revisit it. But I can't and I won't. So there we go.
Life's too short. Watch Liz and Dick instead.
You have tempted me on that one. I think that could be in my wheelhouse. I think I could enjoy that very much. I haven't seen it.
It's amazing because Lindsay Lohan, clearly a gifted actress at some point in her life and then just forgot how.
Lindsay, I hope she's doing very well. She's pregnant with a baby now and life has turned around for her. I hope you're doing well, Lindsay, and hopefully you will act again, because she was a delight. I think she's a delightful young actress when she was actually doing it.
She did that Christmas movie for Netflix that I actually thought she'd remembered how to act again. Liz and Dick is definitely the nadir. Things are on the up.
Okay, cool. I Remember Who Killed Me is also excellent.
Is it? I never saw that one.
No, it's a 1-star, but it is in the same way very watchable.
She's twins in that one? Twins.
It's bewildering. The Canyons is also another 1-star delight. And that is by who, Layla?
Mr. Paul Schrader, and written by Bret Easton Ellis. I mean, it's always amazing when people that are so good can have such an incredible misfire, but that was a weird, terrible film. And I don't even think it's kind of bad in a fun way. Like, that was just like a really slog.
Yeah, no, that was a 1-star that truly is a 1-star, but also sort of can't tear your eyes away from it, do have to watch it way.
Yeah, because I mean, it's just so fascinating to think that this is Paul Schrader. You keep waiting for something to happen and nothing does. So it's like, it's kind of like being in some like weird experiment. I suppose that's the thing with Paul Schrader. He doesn't care if we like him. Yep. And after that movie, I really didn't for a time.
Yeah, he does not. Mm-mm-mm, does he? Okay, on that note, I'm going to go and pack my cape and my Elvis accoutrements. I've got to get on a plane to Memphis. I will be back the week after. And Layla, you will be back next issue with something exciting. But for now, I think we should say goodbye. So say goodbye.
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 Ariel, listen to me. The human world, it's a mess. Life under the sea is better than anything they got up there. The seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world around you, right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more are you looking for? Under the sea, under the sea. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While the deep boating full time, floating under the sea.